It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at how residency requirements on former sex offenders is leaving some of them without any housing options.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news in the Wisconsin News Roundup.
The Stephen Avery trial has been in the news quite a bit lately thanks to a recent Netflix series. We'll get the story behind the case's resurgence in public interest.
After President Obama announced an executive order that would tighten regulations on gun sales, Governor Scott Walker has asked the Department of Justice to review that order, which could lead to legal action.
And earlier this week, we learned Wisconsin layoff notices topped 10,000 in 2015.
For more on these stories, Robert Menser joins us now. He's the storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett, Wisconsin Media. Rob, welcome back.
Thanks, Veronica.
Well, Netflix's Making a Murder series has put a big spotlight on Wisconsin, in particular on Manitowoc and the police department there, the Stephen Avery case, the murder of Teresa Halbach. What is your sense about why this thing has exploded the way that it has?
Yeah, it is a bona fide phenomenon. If our web traffic numbers are any indication, there are a lot of people with very intense interest in this case as a result of the series. So Making a Murder is a 10-part documentary series that was released by Netflix, I guess late last month, about the Stephen Avery case. Of course, he was wrongfully convicted of a rape in 1985, released, and then later, about 2 years later, convicted of a murder of a 25-year-old woman named Teresa Halbach. So anybody who has watched or has witnessed the coverage is sort of familiar with the basics of that case. Probably also anybody who lived in Wisconsin at that time knows about it. But what's happened is this documentary series, besides just being very artfully made, it's a very well-made, very compelling piece of film. It also is done with a very strong, very obvious sort of point of view. All the major voices in the series are Avery's lawyers, Avery's family members, and it really focuses on the ways the investigation was mishandled. There are questions that are, I mean, legitimate questions about whether evidence was tampered with. And it's very compelling, but it's also like from a point of view. And so I think that's a big part of why it's caught on fire. It's not told in a dispassionate sort of journalistic way. It's more like advocacy.
Now, people who want there to be some sort of legal action on this to overturn the ruling or have it revisited, people have asked President Obama to have Stephen Avery pardoned, have directed attention to Governor Scott Walker asking for the same thing. What's the status of those requests?
Yeah, they're not going to happen, is the short version. President Obama doesn't have authority to grant a pardon, as it was mentioned in the news just a few minutes ago.
It's a state thing.
It's a state thing. And Governor Walker, of course, doesn't pardon people. He's literally pardoned zero people, and he's sort of let lapse the board that even reviews pardon applications. So those things are not happening. But the fact that there's such a that there's so many calls, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are signing these online petitions, and the clerks who manage records in Manitowoc County say that they are overrun by requests. It just is a sign of how much people have engaged with the story. And you know what? There are some legitimately disturbing things within the story. The treatment of Avery's mentally disabled nephew, Brendan Dassey, is heartbreaking in the series. That none of that necessarily means that Avery is not guilty, but I mean, it's clear that people have this sort of emotional reaction.
I want to follow up on something you said. You said Governor Walker doesn't pardon people. He hasn't pardoned anybody since he's been in office. Is that following a trend of governors before him, or is that unique to him?
No, it certainly is unique to him. It was a decision that the governor made very early on in his office. I think within the first year, there was a statement made to media that the governor has just decided not to review these applications, and he's stuck with it. I recall a couple of years ago, there was a case of an Iraq war veteran who had gotten in a bar fight, I think 2 days after he returned home from the war, and that the fact that he had that case meant that he couldn't become a police officer, which is what he always wanted to do. There was a call for him to receive a pardon, and Walker just doesn't do it. It's just not something that he's he's chosen to do. Maybe it changes it at the end of his tenure as governor, but so far he doesn't even review those applications.
Are there other governors that choose that same thing?
You know, it seems like it's in a certain way you would think that why does any governor do it in a one way of looking at it, because the political downside is quite obvious, right, to granting a pardon. I mean, and you can imagine if Governor Walker came into this Stephen Avery case and granted a pardon, that would throw some sort of law enforcement communities into somewhat of chaos. So you can understand why a politician would be hesitant to do that. But it's also, I mean, it's in the Constitution, right? It's an executive power that's supposed to be a check on the judiciary.
We're talking right now to Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. We're talking to him for our Wisconsin News Roundup. We're going to stick with Governor Walker now. Other state news, Governor Walker has asked the state to look into President Obama's executive action on gun policy. And what is Governor Walker asking the state to do in this case?
Sure. Well, President Obama this week announced a set of new executive orders that are aimed at sort of, you could say, tightening regulations on the sale of guns or stepping up enforcement of current laws. So they're executive orders. They're not new laws, and they're sort of limited and quite technical about what the executive orders actually do. But the day after Obama gave his press conference, Walker announced, basically all but stated that Wisconsin was likely to sue the federal government over the regulations. His statement was that Obama was disregarding the constitutional principles of separation of powers, exceeding his authority, and so on. So specifically what we're talking about is what is called the gun show loophole. So the executive order, what it aims to do is clarify who counts as a seller of guns and who needs to follow certain regulations, register as a seller, and whether people who sell on the internet need to do that. So that's sort of what this is about. And from Walker's point of view, who's been, you know, certainly extremely pro Second Amendment throughout his tenure as governor, this has been a key issue, an important sort of identity issue, and the signal is that he's gonna fight it all the way.
And of course, this isn't the first time that the governor and the state have challenged the president. Look at things like health care, the Affordable Care Act, and some recent EPA initiatives. Is the state able to sue the federal government on this?
Sure. Yeah. Sure, they can, and I would be surprised if Wisconsin turns out to be the only one. Right. It's a way that governors can challenge executive authority of a president that they disagree with. And you know, I mean, it is a legal matter, right? How much authority does the executive of our country have to set regulations, enforce regulations? What is the difference between clarifying the language of the law and sort of having the president write a new law himself? I mean, that is a hard question. So you would expect it to be over such a hot button issue. You would expect it to be contentious, and it is very likely that it will play out in court.
And we're going to move to the jobs outlook here in Wisconsin. A report came out earlier this week that showed Wisconsin saw over 10,000 layoffs in the year 2015. This is up from quite a while, at least 2010. What is the story here?
Yeah, so we got the final numbers for 2015. The State Department of Workforce Development had been notified of more than 10,000 layoffs. Of course, there's a threshold. They don't necessarily get notified of every single layoff in the state, but that's a symbol of overall how the state is doing. It's the highest it's been since Walker's been in office in 2011. It's the worst number since the Great Recession in 2009 to 2010, when, by the way, it was substantially higher. You know, on the other side of things, the governor points out and Republicans point out that unemployment rate has dropped basically all year. I think it was 4.3% as of November. Labor force participation is up. So it's a question how much the layoffs themselves ought to be understood as a barometer of Wisconsin's economic health. But I think, you know, I mean, it can't be a good thing, right?
And we're going to wrap up with a couple of bills proposed in the state legislature this week. One regards hands-free devices, and the other one looks at fantasy sports betting. Can you give us a little bit of a snapshot of those two?
Sure. Yeah, quickies. I mean, they're bills sort of being drafted, and we'll see if they go anywhere. Representative Peter Barca, a Democrat of Kenosha, says he's going to introduce a bill that would ban people talking on their cell phones while they're driving. It's something that a lot of like individual municipalities have, but this would be the first attempt at making that a statewide law. I'm going to endorse this law. I'm for that. I don't like people talking on their phones while they're driving. Like, just have a hands-free, you know? The other one is Representative Tyler Vorpagel of Plymouth, a Republican, says that he wants a law to protect Wisconsinites' right to bet on fantasy sports. This has been, these daily fantasy sports have been a huge sensation, and some states like New York have sort of cracked down on those legally. And here's a Wisconsin legislator who says, yeah, no, Wisconsinites, why don't you go ahead and bet?
And we leave it there till next week. Rob, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
That was State News Editor Robert Menser helping us review the biggest stories from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
The city of Milwaukee, like many other communities, has ordinances that place residency restrictions on former sex offenders. But our guest writes that these rules are so restrictive that it's nearly impossible for them to find housing in the city.
Jabril Faraz writes for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and he joins us now from our studio in Milwaukee. Jabril, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of municipalities have these kind of restrictions on where registered sex offenders can live. Can you talk through what kind of restrictions are in place right now in Milwaukee?
Essentially, sex offenders, convicted sex offenders, can't live within 2,000 feet of parks, schools, recreation trails, other places where children tend to congregate.
And the city has a map up that I think you linked to in one of your pieces. What does that map look like for where a registered sex offender can and can't live?
Well, there's a lot of red on that map. Essentially, there are 55 addresses in the city of Milwaukee. That's 117 units, according to a DOC field supervisor, where sex offenders can legally live. These are in those areas that are outside of that 2,000 feet.
But that doesn't mean these are places that are available. Some these are places that could be occupied by someone else living there now.
Yes. Some of these locations are single-family homes where there are actually homeowners living in the houses. Others were are apartment buildings where the people have said, you know, we're not going to rent to sex offenders. So essentially, it's very, very hard for anyone who has been convicted of a sex offense previously to find housing now.
And in your piece, you profile one person who was convicted of a sex offense, a sex-related offense, is out of prison now, is still on parole, I believe. Could you talk through his story and his quest to find housing?
Yeah, he was released from prison in June of this year. Essentially, since then, he's been living in a van on the city streets with his current girlfriend. They've kind of been going from place to place, trying to find secluded spots where they can sleep. And it's been difficult for them. It's tough, and they said, you know, we've seen other homeless people out here. He called himself a survivalist. They actually have rigged up this van with some high-powered batteries that help to charge their sleep apnea machines or their breathing machines. Both of them have sleep apnea. He installed an air conditioner in the side of the van over the summer, you know, during the hot months. But from what it sounds like, it's been really trying for them.
Talking to Jabril Faraz about registered sex offenders, he writes that requirements, restrictions on where they can live, not in the proximity of schools, playgrounds, elsewhere, has made it effectively impossible for many of them to find any housing. Jabril, though, this is not a group of people that a lot of people will feel sympathy for, registered sex offenders, and a lot of people, families in particular, would say this is good. We wouldn't want them living in our neighborhoods near schools. Given that, is there much appetite for anyone to change these restrictions?
You're definitely right. But, you know, the first thing is that there are a lot of misconceptions when it comes to sexual offenders. First, these are former offenders, people who have served their time, nationwide, only 5% of sex offenders reoffend in the first 3 years. In talking to the legal director for the ACLU of Wisconsin, you know, he said other people get a second chance. You know, murderers get a second chance, but these are somehow people who we've decided that it's okay to essentially look at as pariahs. The second part of that is that really it's not safer when in places where these residency restrictions are in place. It might appear to provide more safety, but really when you end up with a large homeless population, and the DOC field supervisor I talked to said that 40 of the individuals that he's supervising are currently homeless, and when that happens, and these people are all tracked by GPS, but it, you know, it makes the situation more uncertain, and with that uncertainty comes, you know, you have less access to support systems, less access to treatment, and essentially it makes it more likely that these people are going to reoffend.
And supposing you've got one of these former offenders under supervision, as you describe it, and they're trying to comply by the terms of their parole, their restrictions. Do these conditions make it more difficult for them to follow the rules?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the man that I spoke with, he said, you know, he's expected to get employment. He said, there's no way that I can get employment right now, living on the street, really having no real sense of security. In addition to that, he has weekly check-ins that he has to do with his parole officer and treatment classes that he needs to attend, all of which is made more difficult based on his situation.
So what kind of solutions are people offering out there? Are there any alternatives to the status quo as it is right now?
Well, as far as the city of Milwaukee goes, in the near future, it sounds like this might not be changing. The city clerk made it clear that it is not the city of Milwaukee's responsibility to find housing for sex offenders, and that when this law was passed, it was essentially passed to keep sex offenders from being dumped in Milwaukee. The 18 municipalities, other municipalities in Milwaukee County, had already instituted ordinances of this kind before, and this was city of Milwaukee response to those. There were 89% of the sex offenders in Milwaukee County were living in Milwaukee last year, but something needs to be done. And Lena Taylor, the state senator, her office is looking at preliminary research around legislation of this sort on the state level, and they hope to bring a bill in 2016.
Have there been legal challenges in the past to these kind of residency restrictions?
There have, although they haven't necessarily been successful. The ACLU legal director for Wisconsin was involved in a challenge to a similar ordinance in South Milwaukee a few years ago, but in the end, that challenge was unsuccessful.
So what's next? When you talk to the person you profile, what are they looking ahead to this winter?
Well, and that's an interesting question, because this man actually, he's living on the streets of Milwaukee, which, you know, he would say, this is my permanent residence. And these places that he's been forced to park are inside those areas that are essentially blocked off that the city doesn't want sex offenders living in. Now, the Milwaukee Police Department said that homeless sex offenders cannot technically be in violation of the ordinance, but at the same time, this gentleman has not been allowed to is not being allowed to leave the city of Milwaukee. He committed his offense in Oak Creek. He wants to go back to Oak Creek. A detective I talked to there said he should be able to, and the field supervisor basically echoed that. But at the same time, the DOC is still not allowing him to leave. So it's a really sticky situation, and he said he's worried with the winter coming up. You know, like I said, he described himself as a survivalist. He said he's going to keep trying. Obviously, they're going to push through, but he's worried, especially about the cold.
Jabril, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Jabril Faraj. He's a reporter with the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service talking about residency restrictions on former sex offenders.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
A little backstory for this next thing. Veronica had an epic bout of bronchitis, major voice, so really tired for a few weeks, been hard to bounce back. You're in good shape now. But along the way, Veronica, you told me you tried to go places that were quiet. Makes sense. You didn't have to shout because your voice had given out. And we were talking about how it's surprisingly hard to find a restaurant that isn't crazy loud if there are more than like two people in it.
Right, and that sparked this whole workplace conversation. You and
debate,
I, Rob,
even.
Debate, saying that restaurants these days are too loud. And then our spry young producer, Chris Molina, a millennial, he said, no, you and I are just too old.
Right.
This is an old person, young person thing. And then we should just get our senior early bird specials and go home already.
Dang whippersnappers. Well, there's been some science on this saying we eat more when it's loud because we're kind of stressed out. And some people say if it's too quiet, people might overhear you. So that noise is a good thing. It's been a big topic in cities around the world as new restaurants go over these sleek, modern looks that bounce the hard surfaces, right? They bounce the sound around.
And so we asked Kyle Cherik to help us sort all of this out. Kyle spends a lot of time in restaurants. He's a food writer and the host of Wisconsin Foodie. Kyle, it's good to have you back.
That was so wonderful. Thank you. How are you both? I believe we can hear each other in this conversation.
I think so. There's not a lot of background
noise.
Not a lot of sleek modern surfaces in the well. There's some sleekness
here.
It's not too bad. But so tell us about this. You go to a lot of restaurants for your job. It's what you do. Are restaurants getting louder?
Well, they are, no question. Yeah, and it's an interesting modern conundrum. I mean, through history, and I mean in American dining, you know, the restaurant was really just the inn or the tavern or then the fine dining situation. And bars, of course, were legendarily loud and so forth. But it's only been in the advent of, I would say, the last 20, 25 years where the brasserie and the anoka and the cafe sort of feeling has become so chic. It's really Danny Meyer with Shake Shack, but he was the first one to break that barrier in a major way between casual and fine dining and mesh too. And he did it with Gramercy Tavern. And it was that sound quality where there's always something going on that we as Americans in dining got addicted to. And with it, you know, we can look at our culture with casual Fridays and jeans and everything like that. But it's really gotten away from us in dining settings. And I've talked to a lot of restaurant folks, and it's something that they're very, very conscious of. It's an interesting thing. About 66 to 86 decibels is a good warm zone, really in the 70s. But when you get beyond that, and Zagat did a survey in 2014 and found that over 70% of the people that responded, and this was a national survey, thought that restaurants were too loud, which is really something that's telling to restaurateurs as they build and manage these restaurants.
Well, I want to nail this down and see if you can connect the dots here. Are people who design and build and own restaurants doing this on purpose? Are they wanting it to be loud and maybe pushing the limit to where some people are like, this is too loud?
In some cases, they are. They're managing the sound. It's either they're entirely conscious of it or they're entirely unconscious of it, and then they have to manage it on the back end. I was texting back and forth with my buddy Gavin Kaysen, and he's got this tremendous restaurant up in Minneapolis. And I wrote him directly about this. And he's a shoe-in for the next Best Chef Midwest James Beard Award. His restaurant was up for a James Beard Award for Best Design nationally. Best New Restaurant in America from Gourmet Magazine for 2015. And they put a lot of money and consciousness into the sound and the light. And this is what he said. He said, sound is incredibly important. I think it's the most important part of the restaurant.
Wow.
If it is too loud, people will not come back. If it is too quiet, people will not come back. My thing is you can either spend $30,000 before you open or $40,000 after considering all of the comps you have to create for people being angry. I mean, that's really telling. And he's a little bit more scientific than most. But this is a, incredibly aware chef and restaurateur cooking at a high level who went in and said environment before food is key.
That's really interesting.
Not that food isn't,
well,
but environment, we've got to get that right.
Are restaurateurs consulting acoustical engineers on this kind of thing, or are they just figuring, if they use softer surfaces, like there used to be carpeting in restaurants, there used to be tablecloths, there used to be vinyl booths.
Right.
I mean, that's not necessarily a good thing, but I mean, do people do that, or do you just kind of do your best?
No, Veronica, you make a great point. I mean, the era of our parents' dining and what you were both saying before about taking our senior discount and leaving early, the era of our parents' dining was, they were in carpeted restaurants, at least better restaurants, and there was music in the background, and it was sort of a hushed tone, and you could hear the wine being poured into the glass. And now with this casualization and, like I was saying, this, sort of brasserie and bistro feeling that everybody wants in their restaurants, restaurateurs are taking it in consideration. I talked to the director of operations for a Wisconsin group that's got about 18 properties, and what they do is always have wood floors and high ceilings. That's a key. Only one of their restaurants has carpet in it, but they do these soft openings where they invite myself and friends and family and lots of people, and they listen to the sound as much as they get the service right. And then they insulate from there and modulate to get the feeling and the hum of the room just where it should be, but not too loud and not too soft. It's a real Goldilocks dilemma.
Talking to Kyle Cherik. He's with Wisconsin Foodie, and we're talking about restaurants. Are they too loud these days? Are they getting louder? You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Do you like a nice, vibrant hum in the background when you're out eating, even at maybe a fancy dining out experience? Or do you think it's too loud, making it hard to communicate, hurting your ears? Call 800-642-1234. Kyle, let's talk about the positive side of having some noise. Too much obviously is bad probably, but having that vibrant scene, you're hearing this buzz going on, it seems like, hey, this is a great place to be. Is that the sweet spot that they're shooting for?
I think it is. I think it is. And it's a very American experience. You know, there used to be that argument between Robert Frost and T.S. Eliot, and Frost thought that the most beautiful sound in the world was the sound of a party and everyone talking, and Eliot thought it was the ugliest sound in the world. But I think it is. We all want to be in a place that sounds like people are communicating. It's humming. It's somewhat exciting. It's not overflowing, but things are going on in there. And all the restaurateurs and the places that I talk to, even the ones that are carpeted, they always leave their bar area with a lot of essentially refractive surfaces, so that even when there's three or four people in there, it sounds like more is going on, because we like attracts like, and if we're going out, we want to be around people. That's just a given, and we want some vibrancy. But there was, I did find an article in the Boston Globe where a restaurant, after they opened, didn't account for any of this and literally shut down to put in acoustic tiles because they had it measured at 91 decibels, which is akin to a chainsaw.
I can relate to that.
They were turning so many people off. So it's one of those things that we all, every restaurateur thinks about, their menu and the prices and what do diners want and ticket times and ambiance and things like that and uniforms. There's so many details that go into, but about 66 decibels is a regular conversation level, and we want a little bit more for part of the party, but we don't want to shout while we're also saying, how's your chicken? Like, that's not fun.
Well, so you don't think it's an older person, younger person thing. And we have, Rob and I have been looking too, and it seems as though there is that perspective as well, that this is hard as when you're younger, you can pick out voices amidst a lot of other ambient sound more easily. When you get older, that can get harder, and that's what this is really all about. But I feel like at the end of the night, sometimes my voice is just shot because it's so loud. But is there something to that, that this is, you know, something that young people don't have a problem with?
I think it's a cultural phenomenon, and it's a recent one within the last 20, 25 years, Veronica. And so younger people that are just coming into understanding dining are somewhat more acclimatized to it, because there's no question there have been more loud places on the American dining scene in the last 10 to 15, 20 years than there ever have been before. So it's really, it's nurture versus nature. But our ears are designed at a certain comfort level, just as we can see a certain distance. There's just things that being human means. And restaurants have unquestionably become more loud over time, and it will be interesting in the next 20 years to see if there's somewhat of a backlash. And remember, restaurants and dining and food and everything, to a certain extent, it's all fashion. I mean, it's sustenance, but it's also, it ebbs and flows with what's on trend and cool now. And a lot of this sonic experience has been brought on, as I'm said before, by the casualization of dining. And there's still expectations in great fine dining restaurants to go there where you can have an intimate, almost whispering conversation with your sweetheart or your business colleagues or what have you, and the restaurant will allow for that. And you can hear the silverware hitting the plate or the glass being filled up with wine.
We're talking right now with Wisconsin foodie host Kyle Cherik, talking about loud restaurants. Are they too loud? Are they getting louder? Or is it that people are complaining or maybe just being too fussy?
You can join the conversation. Do you think new restaurants are too loud? Do you prefer loud, a nice, bustling, boisterous sound? Or do you want that quiet dining experience where you talk and quiet tones to the person sitting next to you.
Or just listen to them.
Do you think a loud restaurant is a good thing, bad thing, and you'd notice a change over the years? And if you work in or own a restaurant, love to hear your perspective too. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking right now with Wisconsin foodie host Kyle Cherik about loud restaurants. We're wondering if you find that it's getting harder and harder to find a place where you can hear your dining companions talk. Do you ever avoid going to a restaurant because it's too loud?
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think new restaurants are too loud? Would you prefer the noise or a more quiet dining experience? Call in at 800-642-1234, or should they be blaring? The ideas network at every restaurant all day while they're open. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Jim on the line in Milwaukee. Jim, hello.
Hey, good afternoon. So I own a restaurant in the Third Ward. I've been there 15 years, and I'm actually at the point of doing some renovations. My landlord is pushing me to have an ambience more like Iron Horse Cafe, which is really, really loud. And I'm actually resisting that because, you know, I don't want to have a place that people come and have to listen to all this.
Do you know why your landlord wants that liver atmosphere?
I don't know that he's going for loud. He's going for the look.
The look, okay.
And I think that's what's happening, is that people are looking at one metric. They're saying, I want a place that looks really chic or whatever. And they're not paying attention to what that means the sound will be. And I suspect that's part of why we're all experiencing restaurants becoming so loud, because they're all going after a particular look and not even thinking about what does that sound like. Mm-hmm. Obviously, from your guest, that's not true in every case, but I think it's true in many.
Jim, thanks a lot for that. And Kyle, does that sound familiar with what you've been finding out?
It does. There's a lot of the restaurant business, as Jim can attest, is a very difficult business. No one gets into it to become rich, and most only stay in it for the love of it, not because of the short hours. But there is a lot of chasing success, where this is what folks want, and this is the look and feel, and so we need to adapt. And it is a business of fashion. So to stay current and to stay relevant, You know, we dine with our eyes in so many different ways, or our senses, really, when we come into a restaurant, Sonics being one of them, and Gavin Kaysen talked about that earlier. But I would urge Jim to if what he's doing is working, especially sonically, it may be a respite within dining that people just aren't communicating to him, and that's why his business is strong. And so to not change that, perhaps the environment, if it needs an update, that's his call. But I'd prefer to go into a place where I can speak comfortably but has a little bit of energy, or even a lot, but I don't have to shout when I'm ordering my cocktail.
My solution for Jim, take those hard surfaces, give it to the landlord, and then line the walls with like Velvet Elvis paintings. Celebrating the King's 80th birthday, by the way. We'll go next to Gay on the line in Eau Claire. Gay, hi.
Hi. My husband and I are in our mid-50s, and we always go out to dine, and quite often that is the conversation on how loud the restaurant that we are at is. And so we find it's mostly adults. You're used to the crying baby and things like that, but it's the person next to you is just shrieking, and we're trying to have a dinner, and we just stop talking altogether.
So it's the people talking. That's any other noise that's bothering you there? Is it just that loud person right next to you?
It's that loud, unnecessary laughter that's just over the top. And just jars your meal time, and we just find that so not fun at all to go out to eat. Or else the places that do have the hard surfaces and the metal tables, and it's just this. Not a pleasant thing to do anymore.
Thanks a lot, Gay. So maybe this is partly a matter, Kyle, of restaurant patron etiquette, that we're not being considerate of our restaurantly neighbors.
Well, I would argue the point with Kay. I don't think there's any unnecessary laughter in this life or any other. I think we could use more
but
of that. But I have experienced folks that are having a better time and being really boisterous next to us at the table, and it's sort of interrupting our meal.
Yeah.
My favorite story with that was going to Mario Batali's restaurant, Babbo, and having just an obnoxious table next to us that was really loud and really boisterous, and then standing up to go to use the washroom and realizing it was Mario Batali and a bunch of friends. in fact.
They're not going to kick him out, are they?
Right. No, exactly. So in that sense, I was in the wrong. And he actually, to the point of sound, he missed a 3-star review by the New York Times in his early days because he insisted on playing Led Zeppelin and other music very loud in his restaurant to buck the fine dining ethos. So there's a couple of different ways to slice this, but I do think there is a sonic sweet spot, and everyone has it.
So those are, kind of fine dining places you're talking about, but what about, some other places that have more of a sports bar feel but might actually be restaurants, have TVs blaring a lot of the time. Is that part of it, sort of the way that TVs are almost everywhere now?
That I'll pair up with you, Veronica, because I think televisions and their inclusion into American dining is... I just wrote an essay about this. Utterly obnoxious, and it's a partnership that goes way back to 1947 with James Beard, the first personality ever cooking on television, just after boxing live from Madison Square Garden and just before vaudeville acts that were televised when NBC was a new network. But I do find that a turnoff, where there's so many TVs going and there's so much stimulus. And I'm just trying to enjoy my food and my conversation, that I'd rather not eat there. I think that's a valid point.
Talking to Kyle Cherik from Wisconsin Foodie about restaurants and noise therein. Are restaurants too loud? Back to our callers now. Jack is with us in Racine. Jack, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I was at a restaurant the other day, and I'm so glad to hear this conversation because I wasn't sure if it was because I turned 50 or not, but I could not hear the person across from me. The waitress couldn't get my order right because she didn't hear me give it. I ended up with the wrong food. It's so loud in the restaurant that we couldn't have a conversation.
Are you going back to that restaurant, Jack?
No, I won't go back to that restaurant. And it's a place that a lot of people have recommended. It was full to the brim with people. But it was so loud that I won't go back.
Jack, thanks a lot. So that restaurant's doing fine. It sounds like lots of people there, but they won't have Jack's business anymore, Kyle.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jack has got an excellent point. And in the long run, the restaurant will have some sort of an attrition rate. It's the one argument in that younger people don't mind it so much, and I think it's true because they've grown up with more boisterous restaurants. But in the truth of the American dining, people from 36 to 65 is where the money's at. And you need to cultivate environments that are appealing to them. Otherwise, it's difficult to stay in business. Every brand new restaurant, and it doesn't matter if it's a falafel hut or if it's a fine dining place, has got something called freshman luck, where everybody comes and checks it out. But then it's the sophomore, junior, senior, and postgraduate work that makes a restaurant career. And the balance of sound is key.
We're going to go back to our callers. We've got Penny next in Green Lake. Penny, hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I feel that, you know, Wisconsin is kind of known for its alcohol consumption, and I wonder in some of these cases, I know a supper club we go to, I think the voice level goes up incrementally in relationship to alcohol use.
What about that, Kyle? Is it related to how much people are drinking?
I think for sure. I think that's a super valid point. We are somewhat known, we're really known for our alcohol consumption. The phrase drink Wisconsinably is a legitimate expression. And yeah, as people imbibe and enjoy, they tend to get more enthusiastic. But to me, that's part of the simmering to a boil and pleasure of a night, the crescendo that happens around the end of the dinner hour and then sort of dips down as people leave. And that's part of the fun for me, for going out. The issue is, has the restaurateur accounted for that and managed the space so that we're not all so overwhelmed and want to leave early versus ordering dessert or a nightcap?
We'll take one more caller. We've got Susan on the line in Madison. Susan, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My comment is, I am that 63-year-old person with lots of money to spend on fine dining. And I would love it if Kyle would put on the Central Now website some nice fine dining places in Madison that are quiet. They're in the 50 to 60 decibel range because I don't eat out. It's loud. There are TVs all over. Many of the comments that have already been stated. So having some suggestions as to where those fine dining places are in Madison, I'd love to see that.
Hey, Susan, have you switched to takeout now?
No, I've actually switched to making food at home, which is lovely. I can sit at the dining room table with a couple candles, nice glass of wine. It's got the ambiance that I like, but it's a little different going out. It's nice to be able to go out and have that kind of quiet ambiance. We don't have that anyway that I know of in Madison.
Susan, thanks a lot for the call. Kyle, I don't think we can do it at Central Time, but is there a demand, you think, if somebody started putting up information online on quiet restaurants rated by noise level? Would people want to pursue that?
I think you would have no problem finding funding for that website or having somebody buy it nationally. And I think restaurants would be pushed or compelled to revise their decibel levels across the country. They'd be made aware of it. I can tell Susan, of course, L'Etoile is one of those places where you can have conversations with people, and it is the quintessential Madison fine dining location. But our other favorite is Lombardino's, which is an old Madison classic, but is never too loud when we go in there.
And we're going to leave it there. Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
That was Kyle Cherik, food writer and the host of Wisconsin Foodie.
I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.